Hey there, everybody. Before we start this podcast, take a minute and enter our Opera Max contest if you haven't already. Just go to the website and go to /Opera Max contest, all one word. We'll make sure that works. We're giving away a Moto X Pure Edition, and Opera Max is a really cool VPN that can save you data and save you money. So go check it out. Enter the contest. That's androidcentral.com/Opera Max contest, all one word. Good luck. Hey there, everybody, and welcome to the Android Central Podcast. It is episode number 257 for October 9th, 2015. Welcome to the show. I'm Phil Dickinson. I run this little thing today. Me and this one hair up here that's flying around. Well, it's not just one hair that's flying around. Guys were making fun of me a minute ago. And before that, too. Pretty much all day, actually. It's hell working with these guys, I tell you. They're no fun at all. They're mean.
We're a hassle.
I'll have you know, no one has said a single thing about your flannel shirt today.
I know. What's wrong with my shirt?
I was singing the Lumberjack song.
It's a great song, though. It's fall. It's October. And it's 85 degrees here in Florida. But that's not really the point. My wife bought me a shirt and I'm wearing it. That's the point.
You are a smart man.
See?
That's the best shirt ever.
Welcome to Android Central Podcast. So, we are all here. I think we're all feeling a little better than last week, too. Man, I don't know about you guys. I was sick as a dog the first half of this week. It's not fun. I won't go into the details. Didn't involve a flannel shirt, though.
I've had a heck of a cough the whole week, but I can actually talk now. That's good.
Well, good.
Or bad, depending on who you ask.
If it's your first time joining us, we do this live, generally on Fridays. We do video, we do audio, we do, wow, I got a lot of noise going on. I reset my all my computers while I was gone, so things are going to be making noise the next couple weeks while I find them.
Reset the production computers.
I updated both Macs, actually, my iMac and my laptop, and so I mean, it went pretty well, I guess.
I'm waiting for the point release. Forget all that.
Yeah, I haven't even considered it.
It's been pretty okay for me. Nothing is spectacularly broken or anything.
Everything is so much faster for me now because it was just crawling before. So
and same for me. I don't know if that's just 2 years worth of crap or what.
Speaking of updates, how's that for a segue from something that had nothing to do with Android? Android 6.0 Marshmallow, it's here, sort of, if you have a Nexus phone. So we're going to talk about that for a little while. We'll see if Andrew and I want to talk any more Gear 2 or if we're ready to throw it against the wall, maybe.
I can talk more Gear S2.
All right, we'll see.
And it won't involve throwing. It's on my wrist, tightly.
We should get Russell to show off his Viewmaster as well. Maybe we'll do that.
I have to go get it.
That's all right. We got plenty of time. So that's what we're doing this week. I feel like I'm forgetting something, but I don't think so. So let's just launch into it. Marshmallow. Android 6.0. I mean, we were all running it on some sort of Nexus, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure are.
We sound excited about it.
I'm running it on every Nexus.
We've had it. We've kind of slowly got to know every single feature of this, with the exception of Now on Tap for the past few months. So it's been a slow introduction rather than just this huge thing dropping on us, which is what we've had to deal with in previous years. So it's been more of a gradual thing that we've slowly ramped up to. But it's still a big deal. And I think when we get the new Nexuses, those things will have the hardware that we need to check out some of the newer stuff, like the fingerprint.
I do still kind of think that one of the first things you have to talk about when you talk about Marshmallow is the giant caveat that is, we don't know when your phone is going to get this. And in some cases,
or what it'll look like when you get.
Yeah. Or, I mean, we know some of the bits and pieces it's going to have, but manufacturers have a habit of doing weird, stupid things sometimes.
We know a couple of phones that won't be getting it.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about that. So Motorola put its list out, and noticeably missing was the Moto E that was just announced this spring.
And look, all the U.S. carrier versions of the 2014 Moto X,
I mean, specifically AT&T and Verizon is what it said.
Right,
That's
the only two that people would have bought.
I know. Well, that's not true. What?
I get the outrage, and I agree with it. This is a really crappy way to handle things. On what's basically a brand new phone, you can still go buy full price right now. But if it says AT&T on the back, you bought that phone from AT&T. You didn't buy it from Motorola.
There is a really good reason There are not carrier versions of the Moto X Pure Edition this year.
Yep.
Or the new Nexuses, for that matter.
Yep. I get that people want options to finance this stuff, and you have, I mean, and I get that there's some people out there and
finances their Pure Edition directly.
Well, yeah, I mean,
and from what I understand, it's very easy to qualify for financing. That doesn't help the people that didn't do it and have, you know, a phone that's not going to get updated.
And there are also
anything.
There are also some people who say that they have to, you know, do it through their carrier, and I get that.
Yeah.
But that doesn't make it suck any less.
And it's also just kind of how incongruous Motorola has been with what gets updated first and how it gets updated. If you look back to last year, one of the first phones to get, or the year before, I guess, one of the first ones to get, I think it was KitKat, was the Moto X of the time on Verizon. And if you're a regular person trying to keep track of how Moto is going to do updates and which version is the version to buy if you want updates, then you're going from having kind of a reliable setup with the carriers in the past year to just being completely abandoned this year. And I don't think we even have any kind of sensible, you know, company line from Motorola yet on why they're doing this and what the rule is. And if you're buying a Motorola phone, what to look for if you're looking for updates. And let's face it, if you're tied to stock Android, a very pure Android experience, you are more reliant on updates to the newer versions than everyone else, because it is more obvious when you're out of date because you just have bare stock Android.
I think the most telling thing there is the Motorola Droid Turbo will be updated, but the Moto X 2014 Pure / Verizon / version won't be updated. Verizon has a lot to do with this, guys. A lot.
What do you mean? How so?
Updates are requested by carriers.
Right.
Like the R&D for an update to play with, you know, signal strength and to, you know, go through the individual testing for the carriers and stuff like that. Like, you know, that work is done by Motorola, but it's paid for by Verizon as part of the agreement to get that phone in the store in the first place.
That I'm not so sure of.
Okay.
Because, I mean, Verizon's the one doing the testing.
The one doing the testing after the fact, but they're not doing any of the... they still have to fork it back to Motorola for fixes and stuff like that. I mean, this is how this has been for a while now.
Motorola can't force Verizon to update one of their own phones. I mean, that's what it comes down to in my head. Motorola can build everything except the few proprietary Verizon bits that are in there for the calling, for the address book, for the location services. Motorola can put those in. They can't redistribute them. I mean, Verizon has to say, yes, update it. And I'm not saying Verizon is saying, no, we don't want you to update it. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying maybe there's not much incentive for Motorola to do it.
It's always been my understanding that the carriers charge for the carrier testing. And they charge a lot. It is not an insignificant amount of money.
That's the carrier side of things. We also have the Moto E 2015 from this year, which is not getting Marshmallow.
Yeah, and we've now gotten a clear answer on that. I was really hoping that at first it would be, you know, like an encryption thing on behalf of Android 6.0. But that turned out to not be the case. That it's really hard to pin down any one reason other than Motorola decided they didn't want to. And that sucks for a phone that is essentially brand new.
Is the worst thing that we've gone from a company that was being very transparent about things to a company that basically just omitted, you know, one phone, omitted the Moto E, didn't say anything about it at all other than nope. And then I mean, we've gone from just a whole bunch of communication to,
That's the worst part, at least to me. I mean, if Motorola can't update the Moto E, if there's a technical reason, and I have a feeling there is, it's very light specs inside that phone. Maybe there's a technical reason that they can't do it.
Say so.
Wait a minute. There are light specs in Android One devices, and they're getting Marshmallow.
Yep.
That's why I want to know what it is. They need to tell us.
I agree. It's tough.
Otherwise, it's really hard to recommend budget phones. Like, you know, we all praised the Moto E, you know, because for what you were paying for, it was an impressive amount of phone.
Yep.
But I mean, for the next generation, I would find it really hard to make that recommendation, because especially on these inexpensive phones, software updates are really important to make sure that stuff keeps working.
And look, it was one of the things that when the G and the E were first coming out, you had Motorola executives coming up on stage and saying, you know, we have this lighter software experience because it makes updates easier. And that's kind of a bit of a half-truth, but that was the argument that they used. And if they're just taking the same line that maybe a Samsung or an LG would with a lower spec device and just keeping it on the older OS, even if you do get maintenance releases or whatever, then that's kind of crappy.
I want
to
say
that was the worst part about that was the poster that everyone pointed to afterwards that was promising software updates and the fine print underneath that said at least one software update. And it did technically get that one software update from 5.0 to 5.1.
Yeah.
And so that's...
See, I hesitate pointing to that because now you're getting into marketing land.
But I mean... when the fine print is there.
But that said, I mean, I'm absolutely hesitant now if somebody says, should I get the Moto X? And I'm, you know, normally I would without hesitation say, yeah, absolutely, it's going to get updated. Awesome. I was at a dinner party last Saturday night, and I was speaking to a woman, you know, not middle-aged, but, you know, like my parents' age, you know, older than me. And she just got a Nexus 5, which, you know, seems a little silly now, but whatever. And the reason she said she got it was, you know, for Google updates. And this is somebody who's not, you know, overly tech savvy. But I can I say that about Motorola now? Can I honestly recommend that?
No. I want to walk back my recommendation on the Moto G just in case.
And it's tough to... God, that's tough to say. That's really hard to say right now, but it's not untrue.
Man. And it's maybe just a continuation of something we've seen in Europe for a while. I mean, the old Motorola under Google was really, really good with US updates, but then it reaches kind of the weird international Motorola, and you have waits of maybe 3 or 4 months on top of when it hits the US devices and what is effectively the same unlocked hardware. And it's, you know, it's almost like the focus on updates has been exclusively a US thing, and now maybe they're thinking more internationally, and it's just like, okay, it's not worth the money.
After being one of the people that got one of the updates on the 2013, or was it 2014, the first Moto X Pure, I'm happy with waiting 2 or 3 months for a good update.
Yeah, the lollipop update on the last Moto X was not anything to write home about.
I feel like I've said this every week, but go back to the Motorola event from this summer when I sat down with a VP of software, and you know he said, we went too fast.
Yeah,
Google's code was not ready. We shoved it in there, and it was not a good result.
And it seemed that they learned from that. I mean, they took their time, and from what I understand, the latest Lollipop update is nice and stable and makes for a good phone. But, you know, not everybody is Google. Google pushes out something full of bugs. They've got this army of people right there to work on it and try to fix it as fast as they can.
And by the way, if we were at this point last year, we would have already had updates for something, probably. Something non-Nexus.
And it would have been broken.
Yeah, it's not just exclusively a Motorola problem. We had LG putting out press releases saying, LG is the first with Android 5.0 on the G3 in Poland.
In Poland.
And lo and behold, if you flash that original Polish release on any European G4, it was a mess. Battery life was terrible. There were the same performance issues that were in the really early G3 builds. It was not a good release. So it was something that affected everyone. I don't think anyone that released 5.0 in 2014... you know, had a good result out of that. It was a mess for quite a long time.
Tell you who really affected was our friends in Poland. Oh, man. How are we on the Nexus devices? I'm only running it on my Nexus 9 right now because I've got a Project Fi Nexus 6.
I've got it on the 9 and the 6. I've not really used the 6. The 9 is actually a big step forward from where I was.
Yeah,
it got good. You know, it got from unusable to usable with 5.0 to 5.1 and a little bit better with 5.1.1. I think now on 6... basically, all of the weird performance issues that you would have seen on a Nexus 9 if you had it from launch, completely gone now. It's like a different tablet.
I'm most impressed with it on the Nexus 5.
Really?
Yes, because if I didn't do this for a living and still had a Nexus 5 that didn't have a burned-out battery inside, I wouldn't need to buy another phone for you.
Sorry, I take that back. I've actually got it on this white Nexus 5 because I was doing some testing, yeah. I want to talk about real quick, because one of the bigger changes in Marshmallow is the permissions, and I've been farting around with this for a day now, looking at the permissions. And I think mostly I'm pretty happy with the direction it's going, and if you don't know, we're switching from ahead of time permissions. When is that what it's called? I guess whatever. When you install the app, it would say, "Hey, I have permission to access, you know, your contacts and your calendar and your camera and whatever and all that." Now there are, you know, two classifications of access. One is just regular or whatever, and the other one is, you know, dangerous. And the dangerous stuff, they will, you know, you will approve at runtime, and the camera is one of them. So the first time you go to take a picture from within the Twitter app, it's going to pop up a little something that says, "Hey, you want to use the camera? You know, allow it, don't allow it." But what I found in some of these early apps, and, you know, developers have only been able to push out updated apps for M for like a month or so now. So I'm just seeing these for the first time. I hadn't really run into them before over the past couple of weeks. What I found in Twitter and Facebook specifically is that you're getting first a notification from the app that says, "We would like to access your camera. Allow or don't allow." And you hit allow, and then you get the system permission that pops up and says, "Do you want to let Twitter access your camera? Allow or disallow?" And my first thought was, well, I thought I just approved that. Why am I hitting this again?
Well, now, I like that. It's just hear me out. Hear me out. I don't.
And we've
want
been arguing this all day here. So.
I don't want the Twitter app to be able to directly change my system permissions. I want a authentic Android from Google or Samsung or LG or whoever. Okay, this is the only way I can change my permission settings through this dialogue from the company that made my phone. I don't want Twitter to be able to dig into my settings and change anything.
Yeah, but I think that we could do without the two pop-ups. I think we could go straight to the system. I agree with you that you want a consistent system dialogue. Like, no matter what app you're in, if it's trying to access the camera, you're going to see the same system dialogue to allow it. I think that there's a problem if it's one pop-up to explain it. And, of course, those pop-ups look different from the system dialogue, I think, which definitely hurts the experience because it's two different things. And it just looks a little tacked on. You just have this random string from Twitter or Facebook. And then, of course, whether or not it's a next button or an allow button or whatever is different. But I just think that you could go straight to the system dialogue would be fine.
So here's what I found, and I think you're both right. The Twitter and Facebook, the initial one you get, it looks like it could be a system dialogue. And it really is the allow button there that gets me. Because
I feel like Google probably should have put more restrictions on that.
Maybe a little bit. I mean, what are you going to restrict? How you notify someone? I think there are best practices at work here, and I think it's going to improve.
And look, the average user isn't going to differentiate between system notifications and app notifications.
Right, they're just going to be like, I thought I just did that.
A dialogue, right?
Yeah, it's just annoying to have two. Yeah, either way.
I agree with Jerry. I think two checkpoints, I wouldn't go more than two. Two checkpoints, you know, making you stop, making you think about what it is you're approving, that's not in and of itself a bad thing. But on the other hand, when I'm hitting a camera icon within an app, that already gives me context.
Yeah, I don't think that needs explanation.
That's very subjective. I need explanation if something that I've installed to my SD card asks for read and write storage permissions. Because I know what it does. That doesn't mean somebody else knows what it does. We can't think too hard about what other people might want or need.
Well, and see, where that's also gotten interesting is when you, I think it was Facebook, when you first hit the, you know, add a photo to this status update thing, whatever, it tries to populate the photos that are already in your gallery so you can choose from them, right? Well, it needs a permission to do that. But that I could see still being, and the system permission, you know, pop-ups are still sort of this nerdy engineering speak that, you know, not unlike what we had before. It still sounds a little scary. So there's going to be a lot of room, I think, for developers to smartly inform the users about what, you know, these are the permissions we need, and they have to decide which ones they want to present up front at first launch and which ones they really want to save till runtime. Hangouts was interesting, and I had to kind of force this to show up, but I found it like a first run permissions thing where it said, and we'll have a post up over the weekend if you haven't seen it by now, this first run thing that says, "Hey, to use contacts, we need to, you know, you need to be able to talk to your friends. And to do that, we need access to your contacts." And it's a good full screen, you know, explainer. And then you get the system dialogue. And I'm fine with that. I think that worked really well. Obviously, you don't want a full screen explainer on every permission, but at first run like that, I thought that was pretty well done. So, go ahead.
That latest video you and I watched today from the Android developers about this, that little flow chart, you think about how that flow chart reads, and we'll have a link to that video. I'll remind Phil to put it in the
podcast. It's in the post already, yeah.
Okay. The developer, like Twitter or Facebook or Google for Hangouts, uses their dialogue to explain what the permission is and why they need it, and then they gracefully direct you to the place where you can okay that permission. I think that's if everybody would follow that kind of flow like they did with Hangouts, I think that would satisfy most of us.
And that's my point. Explain it. Don't make me think I'm approving it with the app.
Right.
With the app dialogue. Wait for the system dialogue. Again, I don't think it's a huge deal. It's just repetitive and something I think that can be done a little better.
And that comes with the territory of being one of the first. Twitter and Facebook jumped up on it. And we're going to critique the heck out of it.
Yeah, and props to them for being early. I mean, when was the last time Facebook was early for anything like that? So, and this is something we're going to have to deal with the Android Central app. We're already talking about it. It's going to be
a long 6 months.
Yeah, it is.
This isn't going to stop.
No, only 6 months? It's going to be 6 months before a lot of people even begin to see this.
Well, right. But, I mean, we're going to see app developers fumble around with this over the last 6 months, the next 6 months.
Maybe this is one of those times when slow updates is a good thing.
And for the vast majority of people on Lollipop and KitKat and everything below, it's going to be completely invisible until it's
worked out. Business as usual. Well, yeah.
What I'm mostly curious about is if I have the latest version of Twitter on my Lollipop Nexus 5 and I've okayed these permissions at runtime, when I update to Marshmallow, it doesn't ask me these permissions again. That kind of defeats the reason that they have runtime permissions is because not everybody reads them when you install them. So they already assume I didn't read them when I installed the Twitter app. They gave me a method so I can approve permissions to make me more safe, yet they don't show them to me.
I think there's probably like an app data related reason why you're not doing that. If you already have a bunch of app data associated with an app, you're not going in from a fresh install, then you have maybe a situation where an app hasn't declared a permission and then you go into it and it doesn't have that permission and it just crashes. That's probably what they're trying to avoid. But I agree, yeah, from a perspective of understanding what you're giving apps access to, it's not the greatest, but I think they're just doing it to avoid technical headaches that way.
If you're listening at home and your eyes are just glossing over right now, I don't blame you. This is heady stuff, but it is important, especially for all the, all the complaining we've done over the years about how bad the permission system is, or not necessarily that it's bad, it's just...
Don't lump me in with your Wii. I loved declaring before you installed. I thought that was great.
I just think it's important to understand that runtime permission system doesn't necessarily just instantly fix everything and mean that there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, we've seen for a long time on iOS how annoying it can be to have runtime permissions. And just switching to a runtime permission model fixes a lot of problems, but it introduces new UX problems as well.
And it also doesn't mean you're only going to ever see permissions at runtime.
We're also talking about an operating system. Like, a big part of the 6.0 update is a whole lot of little things that reduce the amount of button presses that you make in order to do stuff. And this is the one part of that that kind of feels like a walk backwards, because there are definitely a lot more button presses involved in this new permission system. But a lot of the rest of the operating system, as a result of just the dozens of little changes in 6.0, are really all about decreasing the amount of buttons that you press to do stuff.
Yep. Anything else that we've seen over the past week that we want to talk about? I mean, this won't be the only week we talk about it. But
the transition animations.
Yeah.
I can't get past them.
They're so nice.
It's beautiful.
All right, well, I'll tell you what. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk some more Marshmallow. We're not done. We'll keep going. No permissions.
25-minute segment on those transition animations.
I know. Here it comes. Right up. Strap in. Everybody go to the bathroom. We'll wait.
Okay. Disconnect your network. Yes. And then when it's reconnecting, look at the network signal indicator up top. There's actually little progress dots to let you know it's doing something instead of just sitting there.
All right, when you come back, we'll talk about that some more. Hang on, be right back. This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by Braintree. Developers around the world have embraced the Braintree V.0 SDK as the easiest way to add secure mobile payments to their apps and websites. No matter what payment type, Braintree accepts it. Apple Pay, Android Pay, PayPal, Venmo, credit cards, even Bitcoin. And if something new pops up, they'll support that too. It's the same payment solution used by Uber, Airbnb, and GitHub, so you know it scales. And integrating it into your app is as easy as inserting a few lines of code. But don't take our word for it. Try out the sandbox and see for yourself at braintreepayments.com/androidcentral. All right, Jerry, how do I do this? What am I doing? What am I looking for?
Disconnect your network. Go in and not airplane mode, but
I know what you mean, yeah.
Go I was in and, half expecting Phil just to disappear from the podcast.
And, stuff like that.
And then when you're picking, you know, your new network, watch the network indicator in the status bar up at the top.
Do I need to turn? I need to turn Wi-Fi off first, don't I? What other, while I'm futzing around with this, what other animations have you seen that you were madly in love with?
When you open an app, it's the same animation, but it's just so much cleaner and smoother.
Yep.
The transitions when
it opens from the app icon.
Yeah.
Kind of explodes out from the app icon.
That was a big part of Material was transitions and animations coming from one place and going to another and not just kind of happening.
Yes, having a reaction to where you tapped.
Yeah.
You know what? I really can't wait for LG to update their phones and for this not to be in that update.
Or when you're going to tap on one icon and it's going to expand from another and just fly around random directions.
The bouncing at the end of lists, you know, for the longest time, only Apple and HTC could do that well. Now it looks beautiful. It's just tiny touches that make me feel that this is finally polished instead of just functional.
Russell, you were talking about Doze. What is Doze?
So Google is now stepping in, and if your phone is inactive, by which I mean you have set it down somewhere and are not touching it for a while, Google Android steps in and tells all the apps to shut up. No checking the internet, no refreshing, no wake locks, none of that stuff. Android as a platform now makes all of these apps be quiet, and as a result, your battery just goes and goes and goes when you're not when the phone's sitting there doing nothing like it should.
There's one exception to that, though, right? And that is, you know, high priority notifications, and not just like, not just like a text message necessarily, but like super like an emergency alert. Text messages might. I forget which.
Text messages, your normal cellular stuff. Yeah, high priority notifications are things like text messages and phone calls and stuff like that. Anything that would not affect your normal cellular communication, but on a Wi-Fi device like the Nexus 9. Mm-hmm. You don't have any of that stuff. So when you set it somewhere, it just goes.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say, that on a Wi-Fi tablet, this is hugely noticeable, especially a Wi-Fi tablet that doesn't do much in the background, that is left maybe for a day, that doesn't have any cellular stuff or really that many notifications taking in the background. And like I said, the Nexus 9 is like a new device with this update in a lot of ways, not just performance, but the fact that it doesn't just die when you leave it.
And an interesting aside, people were concerned with, will developers abuse and mark their notifications as high priority?
Oh, have you seen what Google's doing about that?
Yes, I saw Diane Hackborn said,
yeah,
forcing them to go through Google servers, and they're going to monitor that stuff.
They're totally going to steal your data.
Bad developer, no soup for you.
No, they're not. Google's not stealing your data doing that. I was kidding.
I ignored that, pretended that you never even said it.
Speaking of stealing your data.
Yes.
We now.
actually, hang on. Before you go to that, so I left the Nexus 5 in my car last night, and it still lost 30 percentage points. What did I do wrong?
What's your network signal look like?
I don't know.
Is it T-Mobile?
Haven't slept in my garage in a long time. Yeah, it is, actually.
Probably just poor network signal.
And I'd forgotten to turn Wi-Fi on, actually.
And Phil, by the way, how old is that Nexus 5?
This one?
Yeah.
A couple years. I don't know
why. Yeah, exactly. So,
what? Does your battery only last 5 minutes normally?
I haven't used it in so long. I have no idea.
He hasn't really used that.
But I mean, it just obviously it obviously didn't, doze and just shut down.
Well, it probably did doze, but while it was dozing, it was constantly looking for signal because it was inside a building connected to T-Mobile.
Inside a car, inside the garage.
Yeah.
Okay. So should I try it inside the house tonight? And
no, you know what you should do? Set it on your front porch outside overnight. and check.
Sounds like a particularly bad idea.
I know your address. I'm going to go get me a free white Nexus 5.
All right. Sorry, Russell. Where are we going?
So we also learned a lot about how Now on Tap works.
Yes.
And really clever stuff. Like, I don't think when they first announced it, I was impressed that Google Now was expanding, but I don't think I really appreciated what exactly was happening. Google Now is essentially looking at a screenshot of whatever's happening on your screen at the time and grabs keywords and images and stuff like that and suggests searches or things that can be done on, you know, apps that are connected to your phone based on the information that's on that page. And it does so largely without leaving your device.
And it's what's visible on the screen, right? It's not like if you have a web page, it's not jumping ahead to what's down below. It's literally what's right in front of you.
Yeah, it's right. It's what's right in front of you, and it's on every page that you go to. It takes a look at the context of the moment. You know, the stuff that's on the phone at the time, and you know, when it works really, really well. I've been really impressed with the stuff that I've gotten out of it so far.
And it's using this to sell you stuff, right?
No, not at all. I was kidding. I know.
So, it's for example, you could be on the Android Central website reading a story about an LG V10, and you can press and hold your home button. You'll get, search items for LG and the V10.
It does exactly that. I tested
it. Or it'll give you a store link to the Android Central app, I would assume, if it sees Android Central on the page.
I've seen it do that within search results. I haven't tried that within the app or the website yet. But yeah, because we are app indexed and the app itself is linked to all that, yes.
Pretty much any kind of keyword it'll give you information on.
When you get it on your phone, if you haven't already flashed a Nexus yet, it has a little setup, you know, instructional thing going on. Just watch that. It explains it really well with actually a nice demo at the end about some new wave band or something. But it works, and it shows you how it works.
I loved how when Now on Tap was first announced, we saw, you know, 24 OMG privacy posts come from, you know, all over the place on the internet. And now after using this thing, it's so well done when it comes to keeping your information, you know, to yourself. And it just made me laugh.
I have one question about the old Google Now. How do I get to it?
You press and hold on the home screen. You don't swipe up anymore. You press and hold on the home screen, and your bottom, the bottom G icon will take you to Google Now.
It's a lot slower.
It is slower to get to Google Now proper now. It is not as fast as swiping up, but you get a lot more functionality in return. So,
and to be fair, it's sending a lot more of your data to sell you stuff, so it has to be. I'm kidding.
Oh, jeez.
If you use the Google Now launcher, of course, you can just swipe over. Any developers listening, why don't you throw something up in the Play Store that's an icon that's just the internal link to launch Google Now from the home screens, because a lot of people will download that once they get in.
You mean like the Google search icon that is on the home screen of every Android phone ever?
Oh! That takes you to. I haven't used that in ages. That takes you to Google Now, or does it take you to Google Search? Well, then there.
Well, it's the same thing now. Search and Now are the same thing now.
Well, but if you just tap on the search box, you just get a search box with the keyboard.
Right, but that's what I'm saying. If you hit the actual Google search app icon, that's on the home screen.
It's obvious, I haven't done that in ages because I have that little box up there. So, ignore me, developers. Do something better.
So much stuff coming. Oh my God! Like, we're gonna be dealing with this for years.
You make it sound like dealing with it in a bad way.
It's both. I'm thinking, you know, from a publisher perspective.
You also have to keep in mind that, you know, the one hassle that we've had when it comes to Google Now is figuring out how each of the individual manufacturers are going to handle launching it. And now that we have a dedicated long press event, I am curious to see how Samsung deals with that with their physical button. And hopefully, be listening, someone at Samsung. Hopefully that's not a nightmare.
Why would that be any different than what they're doing now?
Long pressing the home button just takes you to Google Now. Yeah. So
that's what I'm saying. I'm hoping it doesn't change. Like,
oh yeah, no, I wouldn't expect it to.
Well, I think the bigger issue there is there's going to be the only way to get to Google Now on the Samsung phone after that is going to be launching the Google app in the app drawer, unless you have a Google Now launcher. That might be a downside.
Not necessarily. The the button on a Samsung phone is an actual capacitive register. It, you know, you could swipe up on it and launch Google Now on tap if they wanted to program it that way.
They could.
I get the feeling
Samsung went back to
the problem, though, Jerry. That's how you launch Samsung Pay. Swiping up from the home button is launching Samsung
Pay. So, yeah, take your
pay. Hang on. Alex had this all figured out, and you guys cut him off.
I did have it all figured out. Kind of forgotten that. I think that the I think the reason why they're going with a long press of the home button rather than like a swipe up probably has to do with Samsung, right? The fact that that's always been the way you do it on a Samsung phone. If there are payment things that are using that gesture anyway, then you know why not just have it as a long press? Which you know, Android has a long history of long presses do all kinds of things.
Yeah, it's just interesting that Google Now on Tap has leapfrogged the primary Google Now interface in terms of importance, because you know this is available in every app, obviously, but that previously was the way you launched Google Now, and now it's saying, you know, this is, we want that top level gesture or button press or whatever to be Now on Tap, which is all contextual to what you're doing, rather than taking you out of what you're doing to go to Google Now.
The more we talk, the less I ever want to use a phone that's not a Nexus. I'm already confused. I'm just going to push all the buttons and long hold them.
We're going to talk about that some more at some point. Jerry and I were kind of hashing that out this afternoon, too. There's more and more reasons I think that Jerry's right. Don't tell him I said that, though.
Woo-hoo!
don't ever tell him I said that. Anything else marshmallowy that we're seeing yet? I'm really looking forward to trying out the fingerprint stuff in the new Nexus.
Yeah, I've got some questions about that. Nothing that I have an answer to, so don't expect anything spectacular out of me for a while. But my biggest question is something we can probably spend a few minutes on. Do you think Samsung will abandon their current process?
Sorry, who? You cut out there for a second.
Do you think Samsung will abandon their current process in favor of accepting the standard Android fingerprint APIs?
No,
I don't.
No.
You know, I don't think they would, but I think it would be in their best interest as far as there are not that many apps that support the Samsung's fingerprint API. There are a good number. They're mostly banking apps and password vaults. You don't have, you know, your random apps that would just normally take a simple email address and password using the fingerprint API. And I think that's really a downer, because when you do have proper fingerprint API integration on the Samsung phones, it's perfect. You launch the app, you tap login, or sometimes it'll just automatically pull up the fingerprint prompt and you just tap it and you're done. Much the way that Touch ID has been integrated on the iPhone. But with this, with Android having it built in, we're going to see a lot more developers just target that, because that's going to be just the default way to do it.
And I mean, I think for Samsung in particular, just to control all of Samsung Pay from end to end, they probably need to control the way that, you know, the way the fingerprint sensor actually functions, rather than just using the platform level thing.
Well, they can have their own API for, and only they're the only ones that use it for Samsung Pay. But I mean, they could do their own authentication separate from Androids.
The way the fingerprint sensor functions and how it gathers data and what you do with that data are two very separate things. Part of Android is only what you do with that data. The rest is left up to the manufacturers to figure out.
And basically, this new way of Marshmallow doing it is, it's just a, what do they call it? It's a security challenge point. You can currently do it with a pin or a pattern as well. Mm-hmm. Think about the way Smart Lock works right now. If you need to access something that's a lock, like if you need to use Android Pay or something, it just flags a security challenge to bring your lock screen back to the forefront. Whether you lock it with a pin or a pattern or password or a fingerprint, it doesn't matter. It's just a security challenge that gets raised.
I'm still very much looking forward to the new just fingerprint tap. Are you guys have we talked about internally, I guess, whether we're fans of the fingerprint on the front or the back? That's kind of the big thing I keep hearing people say.
I love it on the Note 5 on the front.
On the front.
The one thing I noticed about the S6 Edge Plus compared to the number of Huawei phones I've used with the fingerprint on the back is it's easier, I think, to avoid weird like finger alignment issues and misses because of that. with a fingerprint reader on the back, because just because the way your hand works, it tends to be in the same position when it hits the contact point. Mm-hmm. Whereas I noticed with the Samsung phones, it's easy to kind of, you know, because the sensor isn't big enough to read the entirety of the surface of your thumb just because of the size of it, and you only get a certain number of shots to register a single finger, it is easy to kind of get a miss and, oh, it, you know, vibrates, and you know to move it to the correct space. So I'm finding that a little bit more on the Samsung phones compared to some of the Huawei phones where it does just work every time.
I'm not going to use it at all. You can't change your fingerprint if your data is compromised. You can change your password. You can change your PIN. And I do that every 6 weeks. And you can't change your fingerprint if somebody installs some sort of rootkit on your phone and can crack that encryption, and they don't have your fingerprint, but they have the data that your fingerprint would give if it was correct. You're stuck. You can never change that.
So it's, I mean, that's kind of, this is going to get a bit technical. This is kind of like having a password hash, isn't it? So you don't have the thing, but you have the math based on the thing.
Right.
And it's the same sense that if somewhere gets hacked and a bunch of passwords are stolen, encrypted passwords, it means that you can't just look at a field and say that's your password. But if you run a bunch of, you know, computation on that over and over and over again, potentially you could come up with, you know, a check marker that would say, yes, that is your password.
And just because you're a little tinfoil hatty over this doesn't mean you're wrong. I mean, that's
oh, I know I'm tinfoil. I don't think that my opinion is valid for anybody other than me.
Well, that's also okay. But yeah, I mean, replicating a fingerprint is, if someone's going to do that, chances are they've gotten to me in other ways first. But probably through food. But
I'm not concerned about somebody duplicating my fingerprint, but some crafty person being able to crack the encryption and get a string, and they don't need my fingerprint anymore because they have what the result of my fingerprint would have been.
Gotcha.
Well, I look at it from the point of, when I walk around, I see most people, unless they have an iPhone, a modern iPhone with Touch ID, they don't use a pattern or a PIN on their phone at all.
Let's be clear, that's pretty much because that is basically part of the iPhone setup. It more
allows
you to use fingerprint.
And it's extremely easy. I mean, you just place your finger and it unlocks, or, you know, you authenticate things. People don't want to use a PIN or a pattern as much as you can make it look nice or tell them about the security. But when you give them a fingerprint sensor, there's a higher possibility that they're going to use that. And now their phone is more secure versus being wide open. And that's a bonus.
And more secure in, I think, what is probably the most important place to be. And that's just the lock screen, right?
Yep. Don't listen to Jerry.
No.
Fingerprint is much better than nothing.
I
think Jerry was making a perfect point. And even more so because, you know, you made the point that it's valid for you and not necessarily everybody. And that's also as important, I think.
But the interesting thing is, you said, I mean, it's possibly most important to have it on the lock screen because people can't do anything unless they can get in your phone. But I know it from the perspective of, it's super secure as far as, if, you know, now the top 15 apps that you use every single day let you log in with your fingerprint, there's a higher possibility you're going to have a tougher actual backup password for that. You're not going to use monkey123 or something, or have to fumble around with a password manager or something. Which
Andrew's backup password is monkey123.
Right. With no matter how good those password managers are, it's always going to be a hassle versus just having a system dialog pop up and let you put your finger on the fingerprint sensor. And now that's a more secure way to log into all these apps as well, which could include a banking app, could include a shopping app, you know, all these things that, you know, are just as dangerous if somebody was inside your phone.
Somebody already has monkey123 on Twitter.
I'm in your base, killing your dude.
All right, so we all agree that's a relatively good thing. Use it if you want. Don't use it if you don't want. It'll be interesting to see what...
We need to get phones that work with it.
Yeah, and how many more devices we're going to see. I mean, we've kind of known on the sly a little bit that, like, Motorola was looking at it for a while, but, you know, Sony's putting one on the side for the Z5, right?
Sony's got
the power button.
Yeah, all of the Z5s, I think, have it in the power button on the side. It'd be interesting to see how that works, actually, when we get it, because it's much smaller, much thinner than the Samsung sensors. We've also got HTC widely rumored to have front mount a fingerprint sensor on the A9, which we assume is coming later this month. Of course, they got it on the M9 Plus as well. You know, similar kind of sensor to what Samsung uses, seems to work relatively well.
It's kind of an awkward concave one on the M9 Plus, though.
Yeah, and based on leaked pictures, it looks pretty much like that's what we're going to get on the A9. You know, it's kind of like a weird recessed capacitive home button as well, below your HTC logo and also your other home button on the screen. So make of that what you will. But yeah, and of course, if the A9 is launching with Marshmallow, then you have all this stuff probably baked into the OS as well.
October 20th for that event, by the way. I mean, the point is we're going to have choices when it comes to front fingerprint or back fingerprint. I mean, not necessarily choices within each manufacturer, but choice of manufacturer, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I'm just disappointed that the Nexus 6 didn't get the front digitizer panel fingerprint recognition that was talked about. I was fully expecting it as a surprise where you just put your thumb on the touchscreen itself because it's capable and a lot of stuff was in there to support it, but it didn't happen.
I also didn't get wireless charging through a metal panel, but
I think they said expect those like next year though when that was announced.
Yeah. I expected it anyway because that's how I roll.
A boy can dream.
Anything else, Marshmallowy? By the way, we did semi-confirm about Project 5 builds, right?
Yeah, off the record, unofficially, from somebody that knows what they're talking about, the build that's out there now is not for your Project 5 phone.
Okay.
I flashed it. A lot of people flashed it. It seems to work. So it's not the end of the world. But
it's why it was already activated before that.
That makes sense.
Once I know, you know, details that are real details, yeah. Not just me and somebody talking, we'll let you know.
But if you were waiting to flash or not, then maybe hold off.
You know, we saw this with the last Lollipop updates that rolled out. 5.1 took a little bit of extra time and came down as a separate update.
Mm-hmm. I think another thing on Marshmallow, we do have kind of a leaked, semi-unofficial kind of, here's a list of phones that Samsung's looking at for Marshmallow leak out today. Okay. No real surprises on there. Basically, most high-profile phones come back to the GS5, which is exactly what you would expect. Yeah.
We put our thing up. The only thing, I heard a rumor about the original Tab Pro. Everybody tells me I'm crazy. And the Note 10.1. Everyone tells me I'm crazy. Those will never get updated. But I heard my own little rumor, so I threw them on there. Let's hope. We can hope.
We ever go back, and I know I threaten to do this every year, but have we ever gone back to see just how accurate you are, like how your guesses are?
I don't know. Go ahead. Do it. I dare you.
Well, not me. Let me get Andrew do it.
You know, a lot of that is a no-brainer.
Sure.
80% of what we and everybody else on the internet writes, it's what you knew anyway, but it's that 20% that's fun. It's really fun.
Yeah. I mean, your job doesn't depend on it, probably.
Right. I made some guesses about Sony, and we posted that, and as soon as we posted it, boom, Sony throws up a list. My guesses were right. I'm like, yeah, check that box in my bucket list. And it's fun to guess. So, I guess.
I'm trying to think, are there any other phones lately that haven't been updated that were just abandoned that we were surprised by?
Somebody was asking me on Twitter, they have a Z3V.
Yeah.
It doesn't even have Lollipop.
Well, I mean, here's...
The V.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But that was the thing. It doesn't even have Lollipop. And I had to tell them that
speaking of which, the Marshmallow. The Z4 VED was deep sixed.
You know, I had forgotten about the dang thing.
Is that really a bad thing?
No,
because
it was basically a Z3.
Yeah, it was the worst parts of the Z3 Plus with the worst parts of the Z3.
And remember, the Z3
was a Z2, basically.
The Z3 VED was supposed to be the Z4, but it was like the Z2. It's not a bad thing.
Yeah, and look, with all the issues that Sony had with the Z4 and the Z3 Plus, because those two were basically the same phone for confusing and stupid reasons, with all the issues that they had taming the 810 in that phone, is it really such a bad thing that a Verizon version of that, which is basically bigger and plasticier and running a higher resolution screen, which would have been more taxing, with wireless charging, which would have generated even more heat. Is it really such a bad thing that product is no longer happening? Probably not.
I'm sure it was just they had to think about, hey, how many of these are we going to sell, and how is that going to work with the base amount it's going to cost us to release it and support it for those, couple thousand people to buy it?
I would like to think Verizon thought, you know, saw the Z5 coming down the pipe, and the fact that they have, you know, they've managed to control the 810 a bit more. It has a better camera, better build quality. It has this giant heat pipe, so it doesn't, you know, overheat when you try and take pictures of things like the other one did. I like to think they saw that, and that's going to be coming down the line further.
How did they not know the timing? How did they not know that the
It's going to go down to the, you know, Verizon supposedly has this long lead up time that maybe, you know, that clashed with Sony's. I mean, Sony's roadmap this year has been such a mess anyway, with releasing the, I mean, internationally, there was less than a 3-month gap between the Z3 Plus and the Z5.
Right.
And you've got to think, what stage, you know, why release the, you know, this phone and just, you know, consign customers to a subpar experience when you have something much better coming down the line. I don't know. I mean, maybe they were too far along to cancel it and they had carrier agreements or whatever, but it's just been such a weird year for Sony with their flagships.
And Verizon's the last one holding out with any kind of Sony device too.
Not anymore.
It's fun watching Alex hold back because I know what he really wants to say.
All right, let's take one more break. When we come back, we'll give Andrew 2 minutes in the Gear S to.
Oh, I'll prepare my notes.
We've got some voicemails I forgot to open up and get ready, so we'll get those going and we'll answer your Q&A. So hang on, we'll be right back. What does it mean when every commercial bank in the Fortune 500 relies on Red Hat for enterprise software? Or that every department in the executive branch of the U.S. government does too? Or how about every airline in the Fortune Global 500? Well, it means that more than 90% of all the companies in the Fortune 500 understand the value that supported enterprise open source software can bring to their business. If the value of open source is the rapid innovation, freedom, and interoperability that comes with community-powered technology, then the value of Red Hat is taking responsibility for that technology, testing it, enhancing security, and certifying that it will work in your data center. So what is Red Hat doing that's making such a big difference? Well, it's simple. Well, it's simple, but not easy. They make sure that you can get all the benefits of open source without the risk of doing it all yourself. No one else can make that promise, much less keep it. So visit redhat.com and see how they can help your enterprise with application development, storage, and cloud computing. Red Hat, different for the sake of better technology. All right, Andrew, Gear S2, go.
So I've actually used the Gear S2 other than like 2 hours before our last podcast. And it's a smartwatch and it's better than any other Samsung Gear that's ever been made. But I don't think that it's necessarily going to be challenging these higher end Android Wear devices is kind of your, in a nutshell, look at it.
Why? And I've been using it for a week as well. So Andrew and I have the same conclusions here.
It tries to do too much, very much like the previous Gears. It tries to do a lot. And while the software is improved in a way that you can act on notifications properly, it pulls in pretty much all notifications from your phone. It syncs notifications back to your phone. All these things have been improved. And it's easier to get around with the rotating bezel and, you know, the swipes and taps. It's easier to get around. Still trying to do too much. There are distinct apps that are loaded on just the watch. They're not, you know, piggybacking off of the apps that are on your phone like Android Wear. And of course that has bonuses because the apps can do more. But the problem is you're looking at a 1.2 inch circular screen and there's just not a lot you can do. You can load up a CNN app and read and, you know, scroll one line at a time through sentences and sentences of top news stories. But you know, you don't really need that on your watch. There's all these different widgets you can install. There's 3 pages by default of apps that you can look at. And, you know, there's just not a need for a lot of it. And it just kind of gets in the way. And
tell them about the ESPN.
So the Gear Manager app, which you have to have installed on your phone, promotes apps to install. And so I go to install the ESPN app. And so on the Note 5, it takes you to the Galaxy App Store to install it, and you install it onto the watch, and then you try to launch it, and it tells you have to go to the Play Store now to install a plugin to make it run properly, which for some reason didn't install with the main app. So you install the plugin, and then you go back to the watch again to try to run it, and then it sends you back to the Play Store second time, separate from the Galaxy App Store again, to install the full ESPN app. And then you have to run the ESPN app on your phone to then synchronize content to the watch. So even though the watch can run apps independently, the setup process is extremely clunky because there's not a lot of memory. And of course, it's connected directly to your watch over Bluetooth or over Wi-Fi. So it doesn't have the smarts to do everything. So it still has to rely on the phone a little bit. And so it's not even... The problem isn't that it's standalone. It's that it's kind. It's like standalone with one leg. Like it needs help, even though you can install apps on it and run all these things. And so when you figure out that you don't want to do any of that extra crap, you just go back to the normal stuff, just notifications.
But even then, the notification I get the most is Gmail, and you know, on Android Wear, which I have, you'll notice, have switched back to, it's swipe up, read, you know, one more swipe, one tap, and you're done.
Right.
With the Gear 2, so, it's like, all right, I think I have a notification. Turn the dial to the left, tap again, tap back. And it's like, you know, yeah, 3-4 steps versus.
You can tell that it's like it's going over the top of Android's notification system to pull in notifications and yank them to the watch. When a notification hits your phone, you wait 2 or 3 seconds and then it'll hit your watch and you look at it and you can't. You can act on, like, if a Gmail message comes in, you can act on it and archive it. But you can't just swipe it away to clear it. You have to swipe it away and then go back to the notification center area if you just want to clear it so that it's cleared on your phone as well. So it's just, it doesn't feel as connected to the phone that I think you want in a smartwatch and that you get in Android Wear, where anything that you do on the watch instantly reflects back to the phone, vice versa. There's not this weird intermediary where it feels like it's doing its own thing. And I think that when you decide that you don't want to do fancy, you know, all these different apps, and you don't care if you have a CNN app and an ESPN app and a Nike app on your watch, and you go just the basics of having a nice watch face, having good notifications, simple things like that, it doesn't do those things better than Android Wear. And I think that that's an issue when you're charging the same as these Android Wear devices. You're charging $300 for what's effectively just a sport watch with a rubber band.
It's still a really nice piece of hardware.
It's nice if you want a sport watch with a rubber band.
Yeah.
And so you're looking at $350 if you want the little nicer one with the you know, the interchangeable standard bands and things like that. But again, there are other nice Android Wear watches as well that hit that price point. And I think obviously the Android Wear watches do less, but what they do far better than this. It's just, it's really, really frustrating because this is so much better than any previous Gear, but it's not quite there yet for me. And that's kind of a downside.
They're kind of going after, it seems, the Apple Watch more than Android Wear with this, not so much a focus on glanceable information, but a focus on doing things on this tiny screen. And you have the same issues that someone who's familiar with Android Wear, who wants just to see stuff and get on with their life, or see stuff and open it on the phone. At what point you're actually saving time by fiddling around with a tiny 2-inch screen versus just pulling out your 5.7-inch phone?
Yep.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing. And that's been my criticisms of some of the stuff we're trying to do on the Apple Watch, too. It's like, as soon as you're like three taps or scrolls deep in your watch, I think that's your limit where you've just wasted more time fiddling on the watch.
That's your cue to pull out your phone.
There's no payoff at the end of that. And there are a lot of situations on the Gear S2 where that happens, you know, where you're tapping into the settings and you have all these settings where you can change how the calls work and put a screen lock and have a keyboard and toggle the power saving.
No.
Is there really a keyboard?
Yes,
there's a keyboard. So it does things well, and the rotating bezel is awesome. Rotating bezel is really, really cool, and the size of it is nice. The battery life is good. You know, the design is good, well executed. But it's like, the software, man, what are you doing?
So that's that's where we are on that. Yeah, I've swapped back to the Huawei watch. I'll finally have a Moto 360 next week. That'll be interesting.
And that's the big thing. I've switched now to using my Moto X with it to get the, you know, because I've been using it with the Note 5. Mm-hmm. I want to contrast, you know, because this is available on non-Samsung phones. So I want to compare and contrast how that works. So far, seems to work just fine once you get the setup done.
Cool. Well,
that's more than 2 minutes, but, you know, deal with it.
Surprise, surprise.
I'll have a full review as well, which will take more than 2 minutes to read.
Yeah, no, look, we got a lot more. I get that a lot of people are interested in the Gear S2, so we're going to have a lot more on that. We're not reviewing and then dropping it by any stretch of the imagination.
Nope.
All right. Again. We got four voicemails to do, so let's do them. First up, we have, who do we have? First up, we have Devin.
Hey guys, this is Devin and I'm calling from California. And my question pertains to the Note 5, specifically on AT&T. And I've been a big fan of rooting and I've put CyanEngine mod on pretty much every Android device I've ever had. But I recently found that if you have a Note on AT&T or Verizon, it is unrootable and they brick your device for you. I'm just wondering if there's a forum or a channel I should be paying attention to for if anything does happen, or if I'm just plain out of luck. Anything you guys have to say would be very much appreciated. Thanks, and love the podcast.
Not going to like her answer for that, right?
Nope, not at all. First off, for a forum, you should pay attention to our forums. There's a lot of discussion in there, as well as XDA, of course.
Sure.
If you follow those two daily, you will be notified the same day somebody has made any advances in both or either. But the second thing to remember is it goes back to whose name is on the back of that phone. You may have paid cash for that, but you don't really own the software on that phone. And AT&T and Verizon have always been very aggressive about not wanting you to have more control over the devices that run on their network. They've got some good reasons, but a lot of their reasons we don't think are very good. And as things progress more and more and people like Samsung, they get better at putting Android on phones, and we all can see they've gotten a lot better, they're going to eventually be able to build a phone that you'll never be able to root. This could be it.
That, and I mean, that in and of itself is not a bad thing unless you want to root it.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. It's very disappointing to the person that spent $900 of their own dollars to buy a phone that works on the network that works best for them, and they have this great phone, and they want to try some of these things they see on the internet, and they can't. That's just the way the cookie crumbles. Is that how the kids say it these days? Or how they said it back in the 60s?
All right. This one's a little long one, but it's a good one. Here comes Andrew.
Hey, Android Central. This is Andrew calling from California, recording here on my Moto X 2013. And as you can hear from the year of my phone, I'm in the market for an upgrade. The two phones I've been considering is the Nexus 5X and the new Moto X Pure Edition. And one thing I've always loved about my Moto X 2013 is the size of the phone. So the jump to the Pure Edition is a big one, therefore making the 5X a little less painful in the size change. And some of the great features I love from Motorola are the motion features, active display, voiceless control. But the 5X has that fingerprint sensor, which I feel is a big feature of Marshmallow and its use in mobile payments. As far as cameras go, the Moto X has the 21 megapixel, which I hear takes decent enough pictures to not complain about. And it also has that front-facing flash. And on the other hand, the 5X, I read, has a lower resolution, but it captures larger pixels, supposedly giving you better low-light pictures. Anyways, I would just like to hear what you guys have experienced in your use of the phones. And love the show. Keep up the great work.
I mean, a lot of the new Nexus stuff still has to wait. And God, there's so many people asking, when's the review going to be out? When's the embargo lift? I don't know either of those questions. I don't know if there is an embargo.
Everybody makes it sound like there's some crazy conspiracy, yeah, that we're all holding out on it.
I know we answered one of those questions last week. I mean, there is no conspiracy, and if there is an embargo, I don't talk about it. So, cool. You know, the fact that I even said the word out loud should tell you something.
I'm personally looking at the Play Store waiting for that to, or the Google Store waiting for that order status to update. That would be great.
Some people saw that. I don't know. Anyone got any feelings?
I know the 2013 Moto X, as far as the size goes, I feel you, man. That was that. I don't think we're ever going to be able to go back to that. So, and from what I've handled very briefly of the Pure, it's big.
It's really big.
It feels bigger in my hands than my Nexus 6 does.
Maybe I'll send you one, or maybe I'll send you this one along with the Nexus. We'll see.
As long as it's along with the Nexus. Yeah. You can stuck anything else.
I know. See, I caught myself there. Hey, speaking of big phones, look what I got. You guys not watching the video, this is a Sprint Evo 4G.
Remember when the comments were full of people screaming that that was huge?
I remember when it was huge.
They called it a kickstand.
Wonder how much, where's my Moto X? Let's see.
It was also 15 millimeters thick.
Yeah. Just saying. All right. I mean, the short answer is hang out a little bit. We need to spend some time with the Nexus phones and not just, as awesome as my hands-on was, that's a very, very short amount of time. We need more.
Also worth pointing out that something missing from the Marshmallow experience on the Nexus phones is going to be what happens when you play with removable storage.
Yep.
I think this whole adaptable storage thing is going to be a way bigger deal than we're talking about so far. Yeah. And the Moto X Pure Edition's got an SD card slot there, so keep that in mind as well. That does not make your decision any easier, and I apologize.
Is it adaptable or adaptable?
Adaptable, because it basically makes it a part of the operating. It makes it a part of the primary storage stack.
Cool.
It's a good and bad thing, and when we can actually do it, I know me and Russell are going to tear into it. And I got
Phil doing it earlier on the Nexus Player.
Yep, it works. How about that?
But it's a good way. It took Google long enough to make SD cards a little, from my taste, secure enough to use.
Sure.
But looks like they're on the right path with that. So Russell's right. That's something to think about. You could have a Moto X or Moto Pure, whatever they call it now, with unlimited storage potentially.
Theoretically, sort of, not really.
And the trade-off there, we should say, is always going to be performance.
Right.
I don't know, man. You put a Class 10 drive in that thing and it gets treated like a native disk. There may not be a whole lot in the way of performance difference.
That's what the way you and I have to do some testing. I have a feeling I can burn out a $200 SD card in a matter of minutes. I'm hoping I can.
All right. Good question. Here comes Roy.
Hey, guys. What's up? My name's Roy. I'm from Belfast in Northern Ireland. My question really is just for everyone on the pod. I'm looking to get a Chromebook at some point, and you know, I'm happy with anything up to like a 13-inch screen size. Use case would really just be, you know, the regular stuff, just web browsing, email, messaging through like Hangouts, WhatsApp web, you know, social media sites and stuff. You know, I'd really love something with a nice, you know, a nice, decent screen, you know, keyboard and trackpad. You know, they don't necessarily have to be all best in class, but, you know, just a nice compromise mix would be nice. Thanks very much for your time. Keep up the good work. I love the site and love the pod. Thanks very much.
By the way,
can I hire him to read me bedtime stories?
I could call this a pod all day long and not make it sound cool like that. I'm just saying.
Alex could get close.
Yeah, maybe. Alex, call it a pod.
What's a pod? You're a pod.
Nope, Roy's better.
Phil's not a pod.
That's tough.
Yep.
Yeah, I know Andrew agrees. I don't want to tell anybody to spend $1,000 on a Pixel, but the minute you said nice screen, that limits your options a lot.
You've got to look at this Dell one, though. This one that I just have right now is the one that I automatically want to recommend because it's not a pile of crap.
Has Dell changed their ways where we can recommend them to anyone?
Yes. Are you kidding me?
Okay. Dell makes some pretty solid stuff.
The last Dell I had is 10 years ago. That's where I've been.
The last year and a half has been really, really good for Dell as a hardware company.
So, see, I mean, here's the problem. Obviously, the nature, especially what he was talking about using a Chromebook for, is that they're very casual machines usually, and so it's kind of tough to recommend spending a ton of money. This new Dell Chromebook starts at $430 or $400. But it's really, really nice. It's not cheap and flimsy and plasticky. It has an IPS display, has a nice keyboard, has a glass trackpad. It has good performance and ridiculous battery life. It's a little heavy. It's a touch over 3 pounds, which is getting up there a little bit for a 13-inch laptop. But if you want something portable, I like the new Acer Chromebooks are good. 11 and 13 inches both. The screen's not super duper great, not as good as this Dell one, but you're talking about $250 or $300. And if it's something that's going to be just for casual use, the keyboard's good enough, the trackpad's good enough, and people like it. Yeah. You're not going to feel, like you misspent your money, but really the new Dell Chromebook 13, if you want to spend the extra cash, is definitely worth it.
Cool. One last one. Very good question, Roy, by the way. Thanks for
read me bedtime stories.
get a little creepy about that, dude. All right. Finally, we have Steve.
Hey, Andrew Tentel. This is Steve from New York. After several failed attempts, I was thinking of taking yet another stab at configuring a set-top box. I know the Nexus Player has a bad reputation, but at $50, is it really that terrible? I need my set-top box to be able to play stored video files, connect via Ethernet, and stream videos from various services like Netflix and HBO Go. I don't mind doing a little, quote-unquote, light hacking, but nothing that requires rooting or flashing ROMs. If you guys really hate the Nexus Player, what Android TV box brand would you recommend under $100? Thank you.
Nope.
Under $100 and... Well, first of all, you can't do external storage and Ethernet at the same time on the Nexus Player. Ethernet is kind of janky with the dongle as well.
And no amount of light hacking is going to fix that.
And it's super slow.
Even the adaptable storage won't fix his local.
Well, you can have adaptable storage, but you can't have Ethernet and adaptable storage at the same time.
Ah.
And the thing's just slow. Forward.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's a little on the slow side. Look, spend the money. Get a Shield TV. You will be infinitely happier with a Shield TV. I get that it's a little more money.
Or just buy a Chromecast.
Or just get a Chromecast.
If you're going to be under $100, it's really hard to recommend you don't just buy a Chromecast because...
He wants local storage, and I think if you want to go Android, then yeah, Shield TV is how you have to go.
Yeah.
You can do weird stuff with network attached storage that you can make play nice with a Chromecast.
Fall under light hacking.
The thing about the Shields TV is you just plug in an SD card into the back or a USB hard drive.
Yeah, I've got a 4 terabyte hard drive hooked up to mine, and it just works. I didn't do anything. I just plugged it in.
Separate Ethernet port, and it all runs really well.
Now, of course, we're talking about double his max budget, about $200 entry, but... I think our point is that under $100, you're not going to get a good Android TV experience anyway.
And if you're determined, I would look into one of those Android on a stick things that plug in that's not necessarily Android TV, and then follow Russell's solution with network storage in your house using, there are apps out there. You don't have to configure a Samba server yourself. But that's probably a better solution if you have to stay under that $100 than a Nexus TV.
What are they calling XBMC now? Is it Kodi?
Kodi.
Kodi is what it's called now. Kodi's pretty good. Plex is pretty good. As long as it's all completely legal video files that you're playing, of course.
Home movies only.
Good questions all. All right, let's dive into the Q&A real quick, and then we'll get out of here. I didn't want to go too long. Carl asking about the Nexus review. I don't know. What's our take on the Verge piece about the Nexus program? I think he's speaking to Vlad's piece on how Nexus means ads for Google. How do you feel about that, Alex?
Just go read my tweets that I put out last week, which I will repeat now by speaking them. So it's, I think if you try and define Nexus as any one thing, then you're kind of doing it wrong, because Nexus often means different things. Sometimes Google wants a particular partnership, like they clearly went with Huawei this year. Sometimes they just want to make a phone or a tablet and release it. We saw the Nexus 7 2013 that was basically just, okay, Google needs a new tablet. sometimes it's important technical stuff to bring Android forward, or it's something that needs to be there for development purposes. Like we had the Nexus 9, which was a consumer device, but also was 64-bit the first year. They could have put a Snapdragon 805, would have been a perfectly good tablet. They went 64-bit instead because they needed something that was hardware that was Android and 64-bit. So there are a few reasons why Google releases Nexus devices, and if you want to reduce it down to just saying they're just ads for the platform or it's a vanity project for Google, then maybe that is a little bit true, but it does all this other stuff as well.
Yeah, I think you can easily argue that it's an ad for Google in the same way that a Galaxy Note 5 is an ad for Samsung. Like but it's not just an ad for Google. It does all the... Releasing a Nexus phone does all these other things,
and it's not like
Google and Android as a platform, and that's not a bad thing.
It's not like it's a secret. They say this is how we think it should be.
Right? Shouldn't we take them at face value when they tell us we release these phones because we want you to see how we feel Android should be? And done.
That's and in the same way that Samsung releases a Note 5 because it's their embodiment of what they think a phone should be, and it says Samsung on the back on purpose. In the front.
Don't like it? Buy another phone.
Yeah.
And just because the purpose isn't directly to make a ton of money on hardware sales, which it clearly isn't because, you know, it just isn't.
It's just obvious. People need to realize Google does not care which smartphone you use as long as it's not Windows, because they make tons of money off of you because you're using the internet on your iPhone or any number of Android phones or your MeeGo phone. You're using their services. That's how they make their money.
Garnet wants to know, do you think Google should have included support for some big screen features in Marshmallow? Andrew specifically used this phrase in his reasons to get a Note 5 over the Nexus 6P. Will this be as much of a problem with the 5.7-inch 6P over the Motorola Nexus 6?
I mean, I think my point either way, it doesn't matter how big you get. I mean, the point is Samsung's trying to do, you can argue whether or not they're doing well. They're trying to do something better with the big screen. That, you know, takes advantage of it other than just being big. And I think that was our main argument about why the original Nexus 6 was kind of odd, because it was huge with no reason for being huge. It didn't offer you anything in the larger size that you couldn't do in 5.7 or 5.5.
I mean, are we all agreed here that eventually something like this has to come just to the platform in general? That it is, whether it's this year or next year or the year after, well, it won't be this year, obviously, but yet, whether it's N or O or P or whatever, eventually Google is going to have something, whether it's just for tablets or whether it's for tablets and large phones, that is, you know, at least kind of similar to what Samsung has going on with multi-window.
Yeah, something.
I mean, for tablets, I'm very disappointed that my Nexus 9 with Marshmallow doesn't have some sort of dual pane display. Call it whatever.
That's the thing. We've been talking about that since Honeycomb. Yeah.
On my phone, I don't want to take my 6-inch phone that I can see. You know, I don't, it's too big for me, but one of the benefits is I can see it's got a nice big screen. Well, let's turn that into 2 3-inch screens so you can't read anything. I don't even care about that.
Well, I mean, the point is that it's an option. You don't have to use multi-window on the Note 5 either. It's completely hidden until you surface it yourself because you're looking for it.
But
and I think that's important.
I can't say that a 5-6-inch, or, you know, the 5 is small now, a 6-inch phone is not any good because it doesn't have two, you know, different windows on the front. That to me, that's not a true statement, unlike Andrew, who...
I'm just a bad person.
Yes.
But I think my point is you're at least, I mean, the Note 5 is a kind of a different example as well, because you have more room to write with the pen and things like that as well. But I mean, it really just compares to the Nexus 6 and the Nexus 6P to me. It's just like, it's a big phone. Cool story. Like, what else does it do? Because it's large.
I think more telling is what Samsung did with the dot pitch. No longer do you have a huge grid of just,
as well.
You know, you don't have 4 huge icons in all this wasted space. What they did is much better. A lot of people think they might have overdid it and some of the text is too small, but it's a start. Maybe the next version will be a tiny bit bigger.
Again, that out. It's just doing a little more with the screen rather than just making anything bigger.
I'll say it, for as sort of clickbaity as that kind of post is, when I read it, and I didn't read it before it went up, when I read it, I didn't disagree with anything Andrew said at all. Oh,
I ain't got no comment.
I thought he argued it well.
So. He did.
It points out very, very serious things. That I think that sometimes those kind of things. Alex wrote a similar one about the Nexus 5X and the Galaxy S6. I was this guy that just bought a Nexus like the first 15 seconds it was available because I want one. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's just the best phone ever for everybody for a million reasons.
You and Alex are going to be in the back booth at a Samsung store sharing a milkshake somewhere over your new Note.
Well, not Alex. Alex can't have the Note 5. So.
One big choice.
Yeah.
This or this. Nothing.
Oh.
Anyway, we can move on.
Yes.
I'm just glad that there's phones that whatever one you like, you can buy.
Adal wants to know, is Chromecast 2, and I'm okay calling it that, is it better than a Nexus Player, considering that Nexus Player is $50 in most of the retail shops? I tell you, the only reason I haven't swapped out the Nexus Player in my living room for the new Chromecast is because I like that, you know, menu lean-back experience with a little remote control. That's what I want for my TV. I hate using phones as remote controls. They are not good remotes.
And Crossy Road, don't lie.
And Crossy Road.
Yeah, if you have to have... If you're going to be handing the remote to a kid or somebody that doesn't want to connect their phone directly to it to manage it, yeah, I guess. But just don't expect too much. Just like we just talked about, don't expect too much out of Nexus Player at this point.
Still works fine for me.
Generally. I said, just have low expectations.
If all you want is a Chromecast, the Nexus Player is great for that.
Yeah, mostly. I mean, I still have occasional connection wonk, and that's why I would like to maybe swap it out. I mean, yeah, that's where I am. Tony, ooh, this is an interesting question. I don't know the answer. If I sideload I do know the answer. If I sideload the Marshmallow over-the-air update for the Nexus 6, will I have any issues with Android Pay due to an unlocked bootloader? I don't know why you would.
I don't think it cares.
Yeah. I didn't.
Yeah.
It just requires that you're not rooted and you have a lock screen on your phone.
Again, when you're updating these things, if you sideload an OTA update, the only thing you're doing is manually pushing that exact same file that your phone would download on its own.
Right, you're not hacking your phone.
Yeah.
So, I guess another question would be if you run a custom ROM that is maybe built from AOSP with some, you know, other stuff thrown in, the rooted. Does the fact that, you know, would that be any different? Is it just
AOSP is not Google. I mean,
I don't think it's a problem. As long as you don't have active root access, I don't think Android Pay cares.
There's a lot more in a custom ROM that Android Pay could care about.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
I'll bet we know the answer to this in less than a week.
Yeah. Good question, though. We can't get to all these. People keep talking about using Chromecast audio in a car. How would you do that since it uses Wi-Fi? Don't bother. And this is one of the first things I asked.
You guys are wrong.
What?
All of you are categorically wrong. You use a little Wi-Fi hotspot. They're like $10.
Why?
And you don't ever have to worry because you don't ever have to worry about your notification tone blasting through your speakers when you're sitting there playing music.
Okay,
but is that worth installing Wi-Fi network in your car?
It is for me. You know how annoying that sound is, especially when you're married to someone who wants to play music at like 92% volume, and you connect your phone to your car, and then one of you jokers messages me in Slack, and I get the Slack notification tone at 92% of my car's maximum volume.
Which only guarantees that we're going to do it more now.
Yeah. No, I'm definitely down for the idea. You have to set up a wireless network in your car. You can do it with a hotspot. If you know what you're doing, it only takes about 5 minutes, and it's really not that big a deal.
But now I have to manage a hotspot in my car.
It is a little on the tedious side. You are not wrong. It is a little on the tedious side, and it's probably not worth it to most people. But the big benefit there is you never have to worry about the sounds from your phone coming through your speakers.
You could also just put your phone on vibrate.
No.
Or priority. Unacceptable.
And that doesn't even always work with every phone. When you have a Bluetooth connected to your car, you still get those weird intercepts, those like gaps. Instead of giving a notification tone, you get the weird break in between your song when the notification is supposed
audio
to
audio ducking. Yeah.
But I can just get in and pop my Van Morrison CD right in my dash and drive.
And you go ahead and do that, Grandpa Joe. That's no big deal. But if you
higher quality audio
by a mile, I hate streaming audio.
If you want to stream audio and you don't want to use Bluetooth, then this is probably your best bet.
Then we have an issue of it depends on your stereo, because now you have to plug in your phone jack and the power.
No. I'm sticking a fork in that. If you want to do it. Yes, you can probably do it. Russell will probably do it. And
I just want to see the picture of the finished product with this Chromecast audio dangling out of the front.
It's one of those things. I want to see it
from the rearview mirror.
I'm going to work on it over the weekend.
If it's not built into a little green Christmas tree hanging from your mirror, I don't want to see it.
You've done it wrong.
Roy wants to know if we found any big name apps being totally broken in Marshmallow. It's great that the platform is past the stage when the OS update broke critical apps. I haven't seen anything yet.
Nothing big name. I have a few very, very minor obscure apps that needed an update, but nothing to cause any alarm over.
My son's Minecraft misbehaves sometimes.
Which one?
Minecraft.
Oh, really?
But not like totally broken. It just misbehaves sometimes. Hmm.
And I've had like occasional crashes that I wasn't seeing before, but I don't know if that's OS. I don't know if it's like Google Play services just being weird. You know, so many variables in there.
Should have got an iPhone.
Should we take this this Edward Snowden question?
Me and Russell are mutant.
Yeah.
Do you think that the claims of Snowden that the British government communications headquarters has the ability, that's GCHQ, right? I know that. Has the ability to take control of a phone's microphone and listen to conversations, turn it on and off, and track you without you knowing? Yes, I think it can. It's a computer. Sure. Anything a computer can do, somebody can make that computer do.
It's pretty naive to assume that they can't.
Yeah, I think if you think they don't have 0 days for every single operating system that is widespread, then yeah, you're being a bit naive.
Not to be definitive about it, but...
I mean, there is one, but...
I hope Remington Steele is listening on my microphone on my phone right now. Hi, Remington.
Pierce Brosnan himself?
Yes.
He might be. Does he have anything better to do?
Probably not.
Oh, Kenny has a good question. Does I assume he's talking about Doze. Does Doze take effect if your phone is in your pocket for a few hours?
Nope. Has to be the accelerometer has to not have any motion at all. It's like setting it on a desk or your bedside table or something like that.
Yep.
Or not on a charger. Being on a wireless charger will allow your phone to do more things.
Yeah, if it's powered, it has to be disconnected from power and not moving.
Well, don't have to worry about that with your new Nexuses that can't wirelessly charge.
Yep, isn't that stupid?
Oh. All right, I'm going to find one more and then we're done. One more and then we're done. No. I'm sorry. I wish I could get to all of them. Jamie says, Russell, nice that you get a matching fridge for your shirt and glasses.
Someone was going to bring up the stupid fridge. I knew that.
He's up for whatever.
This, ladies and gentlemen, is what we call native advertising.
Yeah, it really is.
Russell Holley is native advertising.
This podcast sponsored by Budweiser and the letter A.
They are going to come pick that fridge up at some point, right?
I really, really hope so, because it is way bigger than I thought it was going to be. And I'm so tired of looking at it.
Actually, it's bigger than your standard like dorm fridge.
It's a straight up like beverage fridge with shelves like you get in a convenience store. Like when you reach in to grab a drink and the next one slides forward. That's what all the shelves are like.
I got room for one of those right over there.
I have one more question before we wrap up, Russell. Are you indeed up for whatever?
I am never up for whatever at all. I'm up for just about
your shirt and glasses would say otherwise.
When this broadcast ends, I am up for nap time, and that's just about it.
Well, I think that's a good place to wrap things up. Again, if you have not entered our Opera Max contest, you have until the end of the day, until 11:59 p.m. I forget which time zone. Pick one. October 12th to do so. We're giving away Moto X Pure Edition. Thanks to them for putting that up. That's pretty awesome. Go do that. Do we have any other contests running right now? think so.
Photo contest. Photo contest.
Always, yes. Go enter those. We will have lots more. I still really need to advertise something right here.
Bud Light.
I know. Bud Light. No, no, no.
Up for anything, baby.
No, I'm not up for a Bud Light. I forgot what I was saying. Go Good follow man. Us on all the things, Instagrams and YouTubes and subscribes. And I think we finally passed 200,000 on YouTube. That's cool. And Twitters and all those things. We will be back same time Friday afternoon next week. Until then, Jerry, Alex, Andrew Russell, thank you. Everybody at home, thank you. Everybody listening later, thank you. See ya.
See you later.
Bye.